welcome to another episode of Open Book with Eitan and Itai. Itai is still doing his wonderful course in the army, but we have the honor of having Rabbi Reuven Chaim Klein, author of two books, one on the Hebrew language and the other one on the history of idolatry and Judaism. And we're going to be talking more about the newer one, which is called God versus Gods, which, as you were telling me before, you absolutely love the name. You're crazy about it.
Well, not quite exactly. See, I think that the name is, it's a catchy name, fine, granted, but I think it's a bit too provocative. You know, it's sort of an unfair fight. God versus gods, like, who's going to win? It's not Mortal Kombat over here, you know? It's a pretty one-sided fight. But, so I'm not so comfortable with the name, but the publisher sort of insisted on it. You know, they thought it was catchy and that it'll help sell books. I'm like, okay, whatever. The truth is that I wanted to name it Judaism in the Age of Idolatry, which is actually the subtitle of the book.
Right.
And they said, nah, it's too boring. Who's going to buy a book called Judaism in the Age of Idolatry? It's like a history book. Who reads history books? So they said, no, yeah, I have to give it a more catchy name. So I decided, okay, you know what I'll do? I'll come up with a list of like really stupid names, and they're going to just reject all of them, and they'll go with the name that I wanted to call it. So I came up with a list of like really, like, it was a joke. It was like, you know, God versus Gods. And another name we came up with, like, you know, the Baal movement and other abominations. just a swage there, you know, just to make them feel good. And then, you know, they'll pick the name that I like. Right. But then they said, God versus, oh, that's an awesome title. You have to name it God versus Gods. I'm like, oh, no. Okay, fine. You want to name it God versus Gods, so name it God versus Gods.
How did you go from writing a book about Lashon HaKodesh to writing a book about idolatry? It seems like I see a connection a little bit, but how do you make the leap?
What's the connection that you see? It's interesting.
Because I haven't gotten to read your first book yet, unfortunately, but you kind of go methodically through, based on the newest book, you go methodically through time. So I think that might be the connection.
Okay, I mean, the truth is that you can pick any one issue and then just follow how that issue comes up through time.
And is that what you do or no?
No, that just happens to be that's what I did for these two books. But See, the thing is that a lot of people, I get a lot of emails from people, questions about Lashon HaKodesh, questions about idolatry. Actually, more about Lashon HaKodesh than about idolatry.
Really?
But you know, people look at me like, oh, he's the Lashon HaKodesh guy, he's the Hebrew guy, or he's the idolatry guy. And I look at myself as much broader than that.
I hope you're not the idolatry guy.
No, I mean the anti-idolatry guy, whatever, but the guy who's the expert in this, I like to look at myself as like, I have broad interests. I'm interested in like a wide range of different types of topics. So my book on Lashon HaKodesh happened to be that I was interested in the history of the Hebrew language. So I started writing about it. Then I started writing a little bit more and finding more sources, and I put it together. I'm like, hey, why don't I make it into a book? So I made it into a book.
What part of that is like the exciting part for you? Is it the research or is it the writing itself? Like, are you a writer? Do you enjoy writing?
Yeah, I enjoy writing. I've been writing since I was like in second grade, literally. Wow. You know, in my father's house in Los Angeles, you could probably find different short stories and all kinds of things that I've written literally when I was in second grade.
That's amazing. Would you publish short stories?
Probably not.
Probably not.
Nah, I don't. I'm not. I when I was younger, I used to read a lot of fiction,
yeah,
and stories and things like that. But in the last, let's say, even 20 years already, I've not 20, but something like that. I've sort of outgrown it, and I can't read stories or fiction, even like Holocaust stories or historical fiction. It just doesn't really so interest me. Sure. So I'm looking for like facts, explanations. Things like that. That's more.
Do you read bedtime stories to your kids? Do you make up your own?
Sometimes. No, I can't. I can't make up my own.
Not anymore.
I lay down with my daughter, and my daughter's like, okay, you tell me a story. I'm like, okay, you tell me first, and then I'll tell you a story, you know? And then she's like, okay. So then she says, she makes up some sort of story.
Yeah.
And then like, I'll make up a story that's like very similar, eerily similar to her story, you know?
Just plagiarism.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to ask, in the book, I got the feeling a lot of times that you were trying to, so to speak, soften the blow against the Jewish people. You know, what they were doing wasn't necessarily idol worship.
Oh, exactly. You asked me a question. We have to get to the answer.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
But so, which question did we leave off on?
I don't even remember. We have too many questions. This is like the Passover night. We have the four questions, right? So you asked me, how did I go from writing a book about Lashon HaKodesh to writing a book about true. Idolatry?
We didn't address it fully.
So I look at myself as a very, you know, I have a lot of broad interests. I've written a lot of different types of topics that are like so random. You'd be like, what? The same guy wrote that and that? You know, I wrote a book on the Talmudic tractate Yevamos. Okay, a book in Hebrew, like a real yeshivish book.
I think I saw something on Amazon, possibly.
It's not on Amazon, it's on Hebrew books, on Otzer HaChochma. You know, there's that, one of the things that I wrote. You know, I wrote a 30-page article in Hakira Journal, about Siamese twins in Halacha, if they're allowed to get married. Yeah. You know, all kinds of random articles I've written in the Jewish Bible Quarterly about different things related to the Bible, to Tanakh. Different random things. So I like to look at myself as like the guy who researches random topics that are interesting, that nobody else has really written about in English, and at least to some extent are somewhat important. So, you know, so when I researched Lashon HaKodesh, you know, I thought that was interesting, important, and not hasn't been done in English, at least from a religious perspective.
Yeah.
And so then I went into the book about idolatry. It's also the same thing. I think it's important because if you look at the Bible, you know, most of Tanakh it's a polemic against idolatry, right? So if you don't know what the Bible is trying, you know, what the main theme, the main message of the Tanakh is, you know, don't do idolatry, just be loyal to Hashem. As the Gemara in the end of Makos, Tractate Makos, it says that the prophet Habakkuk came and he distilled the entire 613 commandments of the Torah all the way down to one thing. What is that? Tzadik b'emunah so yechia. The righteous person lives through his emunah, through his belief or trust in God. Okay. Right? So that is the one fundamental, you know, the fundamental point of the whole Tanakh. And then when a person is reading Tanakh and they're reading about, well, there were these guys were doing idolatry and then there was this story where they did idolatry here, people tend to gloss over it. They don't focus on it. But then you're really actually missing the point. You know, if you don't think about, well, what were they thinking when they did idolatry and why should you not do idolatry? So then you're missing the whole point of the Tanakh. The Tanakh is saying don't worship idolatry, and you're just like glossing over that. And like, where's the story where they get married? Or where's the story where, you know, where this happens? Or with this miracle and that? That's not the point. The point is, you know, even the 10 plagues. The whole point of the 10 plagues was leman teda ki ani Hashem, that you should know that I am Hashem.
Right.
So it's the whole thing is it's a theological polemic, and people lose that point in the Bible. So I wanted to focus on that. So I thought it was an important point. And it's not been done in English. There are a few works in Hebrew that touch on what I've done. And I think it's interesting also.
So, what I was asking earlier is that in your book, it seems to me that you try to, or you do soften the blow, so to speak, against the Jewish people. That the Tanakh levels at the Jewish people. That they did this, that they did Chet HaEgel. Just like the Kuzri also tries to soften the blow. My question is like this. One of the things that Jews like to say in defense of our tradition, in defense of the authenticity of our tradition, is that the very fact that there's criticisms against our people in our own tradition shows that it's authentic. Because, you know, most histories, you know, people try to cover up their own flaws and we don't. So when you say, so to speak, that a flaw might not really be a flaw or that something wasn't exactly idolatry, do you think that maybe undermines the authenticity?
I mean, even when you said soften the criticism, yeah. If you read, let's say, literally what it says in Tanakh, there is still a very strong criticism there. And even when we soften it, it's still an issue. It's still a problem. There was still something going on, whatever that something was. Whether it wasn't literally, let's say, in the cases of idolatry in the times of the judges. So sometimes we talk about in the book that it wasn't that all the Jews were worshiping idolatry, but it was that the leaders weren't, you know, leading the people from a position of power that they were able to get the people to stop to do things in the way that they were supposed to do it. So there's a criticism against the leaders for not leading properly, but not that, you know, 100% of all the Jewish people were worshiping idolatry uniformly, right? So there is still a criticism there, and the point of the Tanakh is still a criticism. So, you know, if the people that will tell you that, you know, I'm going to prove Tanakh because, you know, the Tanakh criticizes, I'm going to prove the historicity of the Jewish people because the Tanakh criticizes them, and why would they record their own criticisms? There's still a criticism going on. It's just not necessarily as harsh as the Tanakh makes it out to be.
Right. I understand. Yeah. With, when it comes to your book, you weave beautifully Midrashim into the story. What I'm wondering is, how do you decide when there's conflicting midrashim? How do you decide which one to pick, and how do you know if a midrash is meant allegorically or, you know, literally? How do you know? So do we have a tradition for that?
How do you know? It's a good no. It's a very good question. Yeah. It's very hard to know. You know, if you go with a more Maimonidean approach,
right,
so you're gonna try to take things more allegorically, and it's really hinting to different philosophical ideas and things like that. And then on the other hand, it's actually interesting because what's the other hand? Usually, if you're talking about the Maimonidean or the rationalist approach, the other hand is the Kabbalistic approach,
yeah,
right? But then, if you take the Kabbalistic approach, a lot of times the Kabbalistic approach is also allegorizing the Midrashim. And the Kabbalistic approach is also telling you, well, this didn't really happen like that. It was said in this way because it's like alluding to this Kabbalistic right. idea of this sphere working out like this and then it's coming together.
It's an allegory for Kabbalah versus an allegory for a philosophical idea.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
So there's different ways of approaching that's what we could broadly call the agados,
yeah.
The what they call the lore, I guess, of the Jewish people.
It's a good word.
The lore, the legends. I don't know if you want to borrow from Lewis Ginsberg or the legends of the Jews. That's what it's called. So no, it's a good question. You know, there was a book in the 1600s, 1500s, 1600s, written by Rabbi Azariah DeRozzi, an Italian rabbi, and he took the Midrashim literally. You know, as if they were saying historical all observations, historical facts, certain midrashim.
Okay.
That, and then he looked at other historical sources, you know, non-Jewish historical sources, or even other internal Jewish historical sources, and used that to disprove the historicity of certain Jewish midrashim. And he would say, well, you know, it can't be that this midrash is right because, you know, that's disproven from history. And so
which history is most authentic?
Well,
That's part of the
debate. But this Azariah DeRozzi wrote this in a book called Ma'or Enayim, which means the enlightening of the eyes,
yeah.
And he wrote this in his book, and he rejected certain midrashim because he read them literally, and he said that, you know, if you read it literally, it doesn't work out from a historical perspective. See, the academic world likes to look at him as like, you know, he was the first like critical rabbi scholar. He was a very controversial fellow. You know, the rabbinic establishment, you know, almost put his book in cherem, in excommunication. Some people say they did. It's a very controversial book. But one of the great rabbis who polemicized against Azariah DeRozzi was the Maral of Prague.
Right? Wasn't a fan.
He was not a fan. But the Maral of Prague was a big Kabbalist, or at least he seems to be a big Kabbalist. And so the Maral of Prague, he disagreed with DeRozzi, but he actually did agree with him on a certain point. The Maral of Prague would say that, no, you're reading the Midrash wrong. Yes, if you take the Midrash at face value, it's not historically true. But your problem is not that you're believing the non-Jewish sources over the Jewish sources per se, but your problem is that you're reading the Jewish source, the Midrash, as relating a historical idea instead of alluding to a Kabbalistic idea.
Like an internal truth.
Yeah. So the Maral Prague will say, the Midrashim, they're all true. But they're not true in the same sense that you think true means. You, Mr. DeRozzi, are looking at true as historically true or untrue.
It's the difference between, this comes up actually a lot in the show, the difference between truth and fact. It can be true, but not a fact. Well, that's how some people hold.
Yeah, exactly. So the Maharalmi Prague, when he criticizes DeRozzi, so his criticism is saying, I'm also not saying that it was a historical fact, but I am saying that the Midrash is true on a different plane, because it's true in a sort of Kabbalistic sense, because it's alluding to this type of idea, and it doesn't literally mean what it says. It really means something more esoteric and something more, you know, elusive. So that's the Marami Prak. So right, like you're saying, this really goes into the epistemology of what it means to know something.
What is epistemology?
Epistemology is the study of knowledge. You know, what constitutes knowledge, and what does it mean to know something, and to say that something is true or not true. So the De Rossi was looking at it as from a historical perspective. Right. If it's historically true, it's true. If it's historically not true, it's false. Hmm. And the Maharal is saying, no, even if it's historically not true, it's still true on a different plane. It still has a religious significance. If you look in academic scholarship, you know, Jewish education, this is one of the questions that they ask. You know, what's the epistemology of Judaism? How do you look at what truth means? There's this professor, Sam Weinberg from Stanford University, and also Moshe Krakowski from Azrieli College in Yeshiva University. They read about this, the epistemology of Judaism, or Jewish education. It's like, what does it mean to be true or not true? So, you know, with the background of all of this information, yeah, your question is, how do you choose which midrashim to take literally, right, and you'll present that as part of my historical narrative, and which midrashim, you know, are obviously allegorical? And the answer is, I don't know. I really, there's no way to know. Wow. I have no way of knowing. So, you know, if you take everything literally, you're a fool.
Right.
But if you take everything allegorically, you're also a fool. Right, there's certainly,
that's what they say about the Baal Shem Tov stories.
But yeah, the Baal Shem Tov stories
also about this.
Yeah, the Baal Shem Tov said, "Everything you heard in my name, don't believe it."
Wow.
But we don't know. We don't know, you know, what was meant allegorically and what was meant historically. So if you take the lowest common denominator, let's just assume good faith and assume that everything is historical, unless you can like 100% prove otherwise. You know, there certainly were extra biblical traditions amongst the Jewish people that are not recorded in the Bible that, you know, all Jews knew about and accepted as historical fact. You know, it happens to be in Midrashim. It also happens to be in, let's say, what we'd call proto-Chazal sources, like Josephus and other, Apocrypha and the Philo and these type of things that are not part of the same tradition of the rabbis of Chazal, and they're saying the same thing and they're interpreting the Bible in the same way, right? So there's definitely a shared tradition in that sense. So, you know, it's hard to say, oh no, they meant it allegorically. Like, well, you know, everyone else took that as a fact. Even Josephus, it's hard to know when to say. So that was the approach that I took. I did get criticism for it.
Right.
You know, I mean, I like to say that my approach actually follows the view of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, the great Yaibitz. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, he rejected both the Maharal and Rabbi Azariah De Rossi. Right? Azariah De Rossi said, "No, let's take it literally," and then reject it because it doesn't jive with other historical sources. And the Maharal said, "No, don't take it literally. It's alluding to Kabbalistic sources, and don't reject it." And Rabbi Yaakov Emden says, "No, we're going to take it literally. We're going to take it as historical, and then." You know, some people will tell you, and there is such an approach that says, okay, it's contradicted by outside sources. Forget about the outside sources. We don't trust them. We don't believe them. We don't have to listen to them. It's not part of our canon, so forget about it. There is such an approach, championed by Rabbi Aviad Sar Shalom Basila, who wrote a book called Emunas Chachamim. That's how he chimed in into this discussion. But Rabbi Yaakov Emden, his approach is, no, we're going to take it historical. We're not going to reject it. We're also going to look at outside, you know, non-Jewish sources, and we're going to have to try to figure out how to synthesize all of them, that they all work together, that they're not contradicting, they're not going to contradict each other. Come up with some sort of synthesis, if that means accommodating one source so that, you know, maybe changing slightly what this source, how it reads. Okay, so that's a sort of philological exercise to try to make them work together. If it means, you know, coming up with a new narrative in a way that's not contradicted by any of the other sources, you know, a sort of synthesis like that. So do that. Yeah, there's different ways of doing it. So that's like the approach that I try to take this. I like to call it the Rabbi Yaakov Emden approach.
Very nice. So we're going to be right back. First, I want to tell you guys about Pomerantz Bookseller. But first, I would love the opportunity to tell you guys about Pomerantz Bookseller. Pomerantz Bookseller is an iconic bookseller in the heart of Jerusalem, with thousands and thousands and thousands of Sfarim and all kinds of books in English from every subject imaginable, from Jewish history to Jewish classics, whatever it is, they can get it in for you even if they don't have it. They specialize in service. That means that if you come in, you have kind of an idea of what you want, but you're not exactly sure, there's people there ready to help you. There's people ready to help you with price to make it affordable. Whatever it is, whatever you need, you can rely on Pomerantz. So until their website's ready, you can give them a call at 02-623-5559. Or if you're a little bit shy, like me, send them a WhatsApp. No problem. Again, that's 02-623-5559. If you're messaging them on WhatsApp, make sure to put beforehand the +972 and take out the zero. That's +972-2623-5559. And now, listeners of the show can get up to 10% off on most books in the store, which is an amazing deal. It's an exclusive deal. You're going to want to get on that deal. These things change. Go in now, get a book, get the book you want to read and the book you didn't know you want to read.
So we were speaking about Kilo, the veracity of Midrashim and things like that before the break. So there's a Midrash that's very much, I think, like one of the big, like a crux of a lot of the points presented in your book, which is that the temptation for idolatry doesn't exist anymore. So do you want to tell us the Midrash and then we can kind of continue from there?
Yeah, there's a story that talks about how in the beginning of the Second Temple period, so the rabbis or the priests, they went into the temple and they asked God to remove from upon them the evil inclination towards idolatry.
Right.
And then, you know, there's a whole story with the thing. In the end, it said basically a sign came down from the heavens and it said the word MS, and that was the symbol that said that God accepted their prayers and the inclination for idolatry had disappeared.
So, and then they tried also to do the same thing with the sexual inclination, and they saw it's not such a good thing. We need that, you know, for the world to
pop against.
Yeah, exactly. So, the question in my mind is whether or not that happened. Because we see today, first of all, Christianity is idol worship, not idol worship. Like,
it's a big, big question. You know, there's, first of all, there's no such thing as Christianity. There's, people will tell you there's 30,000 sects of Christianity. Right? Some people will tell you there's less, some people will tell you there's more, but that's the number that a lot of people say. 30,000 sects of Christianity. That means that when you ask, is Christianity idolatry, you're asking about each one of these 30,000 sects. Is this idolatry? You know, each one has a slightly different ideology and slightly different theology. And, you know, and these type of things can make a world's difference. You know, how do you approach the cross? How do you approach the relationship between, you know, the Father and the Son, God and Jesus? All these different things, all these different factors, you'd have to think about in order to determine each group, you know, Orthodox, you know, Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, the Catholic, there's Protestant. You know, Protestant, there's different types of Protestants, there's Episcopalians and Lutherans and Calvinists, and then you have the American Evangelists.
So how is there no Christianity?
What?
How is there
no? I'm not saying that there's no one unified Christianity. There's just Christianities. And you can talk about each one. You can spend a lot of time talking about each one and trying to figure out, you know, is this one considered idolatrous? Is this one considered idolatrous? That'll take up the rest of the time on this podcast. So,
what would rough majority?
Even once you start getting into it, you'll get into a lot of disputes, and there's a lot of different factors to talk about. It's not simple. It's not a simple matter.
The way I hold in general, I guess I'll have to generalize the 30,000 texts into one, is that for Goyim, it might be the best they can do in their connection to Hashem, could be, but for Jews, it's idol worship.
So there's definitely an approach like that. I mean, the way the Ramah, I mean, Moshe Isserles puts it down, is that non-Jews, their prohibition of idolatry does not enjoin them from engaging in something called shituf. Shituf literally means partnership. So the way a lot of authorities understand is that according to the Noahide laws, you know, that's the Jewish expectation for non-Jews,
right,
the seven Noahide laws. So they're not allowed to commit idolatry. Right. But what is the definition of idolatry in terms of the Noahide laws?
Right.
So according to Rabbi Moshe Isserles and other authorities as well, it means that if you engage in shituf, which means partnering, you partner another entity with God, so you're still recognizing the one God. You're just recognizing other sub-gods, demigods. I don't know how you would exactly phrase it. So then that's okay. That's not considered idolatry. But other, you know, there's definitely a lot of authorities that disagree and say, no, there's no such thing. Shituf does not mean that you're not, that they're allowed to worship, you know, alternate or lower gods.
Through a mediator, basically. They're worshiping Hashem through...
Mediator,
Mediator's not the right word, but...
It's...
Through
through a lower forces or something like that, exactly. But, you know, what you said is that about the you know, for Christians, you know, that's the best that they could get. That's the best that they can do in their connection to God. So Maimonides sort of makes this point where he talks about Christianity and Islam.
Mashiach, right?
And Maimonides understands that Christianity is considered idolatrous.
Oh, and Islam isn't.
And Islam is not. But he says about Christianity and Islam that, you know, they're sort of parts of, they're steps on the ladder towards bringing all of society to recognition of God. You know, they're leading civilization towards the messianic ideal.
People who live in Arab majority places tend to look more disparagingly upon Christianity than Islam. Rabbi Tovia Singer is another example because he lived in Indonesia. He's the anti-Christian guy, anti-Jews for Jesus guy. And he said that if you can pray in a mosque, you know, other people would say Chas v'Shalom, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a very interesting. I mean, there's a forum, an internet forum that I'm a part of called Otzra Chachma, where a lot of different there's computer software with tons of books on it called Otzra Chachma. Right. So there's a forum where a lot of the people that own this software, you know, they get together and they discuss all kinds of different things. So there's a thread on that forum where they discuss if a Muslim is praying, he's in the middle of his prayers, are you allowed to walk past in front of him?
Well, according to the
because
religion,
if you understand that Islam, you know, they're worshiping the same God as us, right? So then, you know, he's actually praying to God, just like you can't walk in front of another Jew who's in the middle of praying Shemona Esrei. So maybe you can't walk in front of a Muslim who's praying his prayers on the floor over there.
So, but according to their religion, you can't. Just by the way.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and what was the conclusion there? Oh, it's an argument.
People were discussing it. It's not it's an open forum. Everyone can say whatever they want. But
assuming Christianity is avodah zarah for Jews, why would there be Jews that become Christian? Why would they have a Torah? There's no, you know, they're not forced to today. Let's say there's a Jew, even he's not even marrying a Christian girl or a Jewish girl, and she's not even marrying a Christian guy. They just get into this, you know. Where does that come from? Where does that come from? And there's no Torah.
I don't know. You have to know what their motives are. It's very likely that their motive is not that they're being driven towards worshiping idolatry. Their motive is something else. They think they can open themselves to more opportunities. Like historically, in order to open yourself to more opportunities, you had to convert to Christianity. No, that was the historical norm for hundreds of years in Christian Europe.
So like anti-Semitism avoidance also? No. Like avoiding...
Yeah, avoiding anti-Semitism. You know, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work. You know, converting to Christianity, depending on, you know, who was...
their lineage becomes extinct after that. I mean, I don't know how much it works.
So it's hard to say that this is an example of people having an idolatrous inclination. Right. But it's also true that when we say that the inclination towards idolatry is nullified, that doesn't mean that that nobody is going to have, you know, any yetzahara to do idolatry. What it means is that in general, you know, that's not the fight anymore. Our everyday lives, we're not fighting necessarily against idolatry.
What's the big fight today, Shmirat Anayim?
Whatever the big fight is, you can ask. Some people will tell you it's Shmirat Anayim. Some people will tell you it's Shabbos. Some people will tell you it's, you know, being honest in financial matters. Some people will tell you every group has their things that they latch onto and they make that their focus. Some people tell you it's waiting for Mashiach. You know, people forget about that. Each group within Judaism has their different. People will tell you not learning Torah. People will tell you, you know, praying properly. Everyone has their special focus. You have to know how to learn from each person. But Well, I forgot your question. I'm sorry. What was your question?
So, fine, we'll go back to it. But yeah, learn from every person. We're in the middle of learning Pirkei Avot right now in Omer, so it's excellent
time to. Ezehu Chacham, the Pirkei Avot says, who is a wise man? Halaymed mikol Adam, he who learns from all people.
Amazing. So yeah, I guess we could argue that a Jew that converts to Christianity without force, without anything, it's not for coming from a Tovah to worship, you know, the statue or the cross or whatever. What about this isn't something I hear a lot, but the emphasis is that it occurred to me. You know, people spend hours in front of a television screen or on social media, and it seems like that's, you know, Rabbi Sacks said that he thinks that people are going to look back to today, historians, and they're going to say that we worshipped ourselves. So in a way, between the social media and between the television and all this, do you think that there's like a tam? Like there's like a, like an argush, there's like a feeling of idol worship there.
So I mean, you know, people say this a lot. They throw around the term idol worship about everything. You know, when we were in school in yeshiva, so, you know, they said that, you know, I don't know, baseball cards is a avodah zarah.
Right? Did that hurt your feelings?
No, I'm just, I don't even remember if I actually heard that being said. I'm just using it as a theoretical example. You know, baseball cards is a avodah zarah, let's say. But when somebody says that, do they literally mean that baseball? That means that if you go to the local liquor store to buy a pack of baseball cards, right? And there's two witnesses there. They saw you do it, and they warned you, Eitan, don't buy those cards. Otherwise, you know, we're gonna give you skila. We're gonna stone you to death because it's a avodah zarah, right? That's not what it means when they say that baseball cards is a avodah zarah, right? Or when people say, you know, television is a avodah zarah. Or
you've heard that before.
Yeah, but it's people say it in a sort of polemical sense. They don't.
But when your life revolves around something completely that's not Hashem, that's kind of what I'm referring to. Where
right,
you
so,
you were, you know, you people worship celebrities, people worship that. That's sort of what I'm talking about.
So it's not. It doesn't necessarily fit, let's say, the halachic definition or the halachic parameters of what is considered a avodah zarah, which is a question on its own, and it's a very complicated question. What does constitute a avodah zarah? And hopefully I'm working on a second volume that will discuss that. But no, it can be a whole book. You're trying to pin it down because different commentators and different authorities will say different things, and when I try to come up with something that's like general that at least everyone would agree to.
Have you started drawing your own conclusions?
I have some theories. But my point is that people use the term avodah zarah. It's idolatry, but they're trying to say that it's sort of conceptually similar to avodah zarah.
So right? I can imagine someone who's, you know, addicted, mamash addicted to the television.
So let's go with your example.
I feel like on a spiritual level, you know. It could be like an avodah zarah. It doesn't mean halachically.
Take your example of television, right? Let me ask you a question, okay? An honest question.
Okay, great. If I don't want to answer, I'll just cut it out after.
Exactly. And if you do want to answer, is television good or bad?
So we can say what the Gemara's discussion.
I'll give you another question. Is a telephone good or bad?
So it's neutral.
Is internet good or bad? All of these things are neutral. It depends what you do with it.
Right.
Like television could be a good thing. You know, it could be a way a person, you know, sometimes needs to relax and they need some entertainment to help them relax, right? Yeah. So it can help them in their life.
But can right? someone be doing avodah zarah, but then the television is not avodah zarah?
One second. So the television is in itself is not necessarily a bad thing.
Okay.
It's how you use it. Right? The television could be used for something good, it could be used for something bad. Right? It's a tool. Yeah, right. You agree with that?
It's hard to say. It's hard
a
to
telephone
say.
Is also a tool.
Say for
a telephone, you can call people. You can call good people. You can call hotlines that you're not supposed to call. Right. You can. There's different things. Any tool can be used for good or bad. It depends what you use it for. Right. One of the, let's say, hallmarks of avodah zarah is that people take a tool, and they forget about the goal that the tool is used for. Okay, the Maimonides, Rambam, in the beginning of his Hilchos Avodah Zarah, chapter 1, he talks about how in the generation of Enosh, that's when they invented the concept of Avodah Zarah. And the way it started off was that they thought that God wanted us to worship the celestial beings because, you know, he put them in a high place. So he wanted us to worship them as a way of honoring him. Because they're, let's say, the king's servants. So how do you give honor to the king? By giving honor to the king's servants. Right? So what were they doing? They were using the sun and the moon and the stars and the heavenly bodies as a way of worshiping God. It was a tool, right? But what happens is that it gets out of hand. And you forget about the ultimate goal, that you're using this tool to worship God, and the focus just remains on the tool, right? You're focusing on the star itself, on the sun. You're worshiping the sun. Instead of worshiping the sun or serving the sun as a way of honoring God, you're worshiping the sun and you forget about God, right?
That's why you shouldn't even get started with it.
So yeah. the same thing can be true about food, money,
yeah,
education, entertainment. All of these things are tools. You know, food, if you don't have food, you're going to die, right?
Right.
But if you overindulge in food and you make food, you worship food, that becomes the focus of your life, then you're raising the tool, you're putting the tool on a pedestal that it doesn't belong there. It's just a tool. It's just to help you do something. Right. It doesn't become...
It's not the thing.
Important on its own, right?
Yeah.
Money, education, entertainment, all of these things are just tools.
Yeah.
So television could be used in a way that is similar to idolatry, but it's not inherently idolatrous. Understand what I'm saying?
Well, like, when you break down the words of Ora Zerah...
Just to interrupt you for a moment.
There's an
interesting... passage in the Talmud where the Talmud sort of criticizes, says there's these people that when they bring around the Sefer Torah, yeah, so everyone goes and they kiss the Sefer Torah. But when a Talmud Chacham comes, a Torah scholar comes, so they don't stand up for the Torah scholar. Right? So it's like you're missing the point. Rabbi Dessler points this out. It's sort of the same conceptual mistake as idolatry. Right? Idolatry is you're focusing on the tool instead of the ultimate goal. So here, what is the Sefer Torah? The Sefer Torah is a means to study Torah and to master Torah and to become a Torah scholar. And yet you focus on the tool, you kiss the Sefer Torah, but when it comes to looking at the Torah scholar, you won't even give him the time of day.
So I've seen that with the Kotel. Like, people go to the Kotel, they're obsessed with the Kotel, they love the Kotel, but a lot of people miss the point that the Kotel isn't the thing. It's Beit HaMikdash. That's what we're supposed to yearn for. And people come, it's the Kotel, it's the whole thing. It's not the Kotel. It's the closest we can be to Beit HaMikdash right now. So I think that's a similar comparison.
Yeshayahu Leibowitz was a very controversial figure. He made this point also. And he wrote an article. He said that the Kotel is idolatry. The way people treat the Kotel is idolatrous.
They write notes.
I was at the Kotel last week. It was the first time in a while. Thanks to Eitan. Long story. But it's something to keep in mind. You know, you go to the Kotel and you're not praying to the Kotel. You're using the Kotel as inspiration to come closer to God. In our times...
And Hashem's okay with that. 100%.
Whatever it takes, whatever inspires you, you know, if it works, it works.
How is that different... You know, Le'avdil, but still, how is that different from using the sun to connect to Hashem?
I'm not honoring the Kotel. I'm honoring God. I'm saying the same words. I'm saying the same Shemona Esrei. I'm saying Baruch Atah Hashem. I'm not praying to the wall. I'm looking at the wall. I'm like, wow, this is the wall. This is where my ancestors used to worship Hashem, and they had a closer relationship to Hashem. I wish I could be like them. You know, I wish I could be closer to Hashem like they were closer. Like, they were able to experience Hashem's miracles firsthand, and they were able to experience these things firsthand. You know, I only read about it in the books, and it's inspirational. You know, people go nowadays. It's a growing problem. People go to tombs. You know, they go to the graves of big tzaddikim. You know, it's a very tricky thing. You know, you have to know exactly what you're doing there.
It's a tightrope.
Are you praying to God? Are you praying to the tzaddik? A lot of people, unlearned people, that go to these type of things. It's a very slight nuance. You have to know exactly, you know, how to phrase what you're doing and who you're asking the tzaddik to beseech on your behalf. Then that's like an intermediary. You know,
that's the word, by the way, intermediary.
Intermediary, yeah. He gets in between, right?
Yeah.
He mediates in between.
Yeah. So do you...
Yeah.
Well, actually, I think we're pretty much out of time. Do you have any parting words for our listeners? Besides to buy your book, of course.
Not really.
Nothing to say?
You want me to... You have something specific you want me to say? I don't know.
Okay, fine. So if you want to buy either of
Rabbi Reuven Chaim Klein's two books, and hopefully there will be many more coming out in due time. You can call 02-623-5559. That's 02-623-5559. Listeners of the show can get 15% off on his books. Have a good night.